Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. When we look at the history of white supremacist organizations in America, it's easy to point a finger at the American South. Our next guest says we don't have to look any farther than South Dakota. Ken Stewart is Archives Research Administrator for the South Dakota State Historical Society. Tomorrow at 2, he speaks at the historic AME Allen Chapel in Yankton, where he'll discuss the rise of the Ku Klux Klan in South Dakota in the 1920s. Ken Stewart joins us now from Pierre. Hey, Ken.
Good morning. How are you?
I am doing well. Let's talk a little bit about where this idea came from. When was the first time you sort of had an inclination that the KKK had a foothold in South Dakota at all?
Well, I was a young and naive historian when I first heard about it, and it had to do with a little article in the Rapid City Journal. Someone had found, they'd bought a house and found in the attic bundles wrapped in brown paper, and there were 50 of them, and turned out they were Ku Klux Klan regalia. And they found some documentation which kind of frightened them, and so they took everything down to the local police station, and then the Rapid City Journal picked up a little story on it, and we in Pierce, I asked the state historian, what should we do? You know, we should maybe try to get one of these for the museum. So off to Rapid City I went, where I was allowed to take a half a dozen of these uniforms or costumes, whatever you want to call them, and we distributed them to museums, and then we had to start looking into the history.
Right.
The Klan in South Dakota, yes indeed, it was here.
Did you have an idea of the provenance of those individual items?
Oh, well, yes, they all were distributed, as I said, to museums. I think W.H. Hoover got one of those. We kept one or two for the State Museum and a couple of other museums.
Right.
They didn't fall into private hands, unfortunately. So.
Right. What I mean is, where did they come from?
They were from the Rapid City Claiborne of the Ku Klux Klan.
Okay.
And it was certainly one of the, it was a major claiborne. They called them claiborne. They loved everything with a K, you know, instead of the Ku Klux Club. And that was one of the largest ones in the Black Hills in Rapid City.
And what year are we talking about here, do we think?
Oh, about 1921.
Wow.
The North Dakota, the Klan moved out of the South slowly and finally came into the Midwest in the period after World War One, and first into North Dakota. And the North Dakota Claiborne then moved into the Black Hills, or organizing and getting members and setting up claibornes. In the eastern part of the state, the Klan came in through Canton and Sioux Falls and pushed westwardly, having membership drives and so forth and so on.
All right. So who are the Klansmen then? Are they community leaders? Are they sort of fringe individuals in this state?
Well, in the period when the Klan was in South Dakota, was the, as I said, a period just after World War One. The big push was on Americanism. In this country, Americans were apprehensive after the Russian revolt and the rise of Bolshevikism. I think that's the correct pronunciation. And also the large numbers of aliens, as they were called, or immigrants coming into America. The native-born white Protestant people were kind of feeling they were going to be pushed aside by all of these new people, and therefore they would lose control of this country. And in order to try to maintain that, they actively joined the Ku Klux Klan, which was then claiming to be for 100% Americans.
What sort of activities are they involved in? Do I dare ask?
Oh, yes. In South Dakota, certainly. It was all about their community service in the beginning. The Klan wanted to establish itself as a very reputable, fine institution. It was a fraternal order for, as I said, white Protestant Americans who were native born here and had been here for some time. And they had all kinds of, they tried to portray themselves as a family organization. I mean, they had lots of activities for women, sewing clubs and cooking demonstrations and all kinds of programs, even things for children, as well as fraternal activities and all kinds of ceremonies for the men, for the Klansmen themselves. And it was a wonderful utopian kind of situation, but that didn't, you know, last long. It's the Klan's true picture evolved quickly, kind of activities they were involved
right.
with,
right.
which of course was to keep aliens out of this country, to keep who they called undesirables out, to deal with bootleggers and deal with gamblers and ne'er-do-wells and slackers and all those types of people that the Klan felt were not good for America. And that included, of course, Roman Catholics, Jews, Orientals, and so forth and so on.
How did the true nature of the Klan start to reveal itself in the state? Are there actions of violence or of oppression?
Indeed, there were. Not as bad as some states. Now, you have to understand that the Klan became so powerful in America in the mid-20s that they controlled the legislatures in the states of places you never think about, Colorado, Arkansas, Oklahoma. They controlled the governor's office. They controlled the many of the state public officials were active Klansmen. They liked to get into schools where they could control the local schools by having pro-Klan school board members. And that worked to their advantage. They could therefore control the type of education their children received. Things like prayer in school and Bible reading, you know, things that don't sound bad or would be approved when the Klan members took over the school board, and that's how it went. And but the bad side of that was, I can give you an example, in 1928 in Rapid City, the Klan had gained control of the school board in Rapid City, apparently, and the superintendent was told he had to fire any school teacher who was a Catholic. And he refused to do that. You know, this man was an educator, and he in turn was fired. And his daughter said that all he could get after that for a job was common labor work. And that was one example of their less than noble activities in South Dakota. There were others, too.
How entrenched do they become? How powerful does the Klan become in the state in the 20s?
And in the state of South Dakota, not very powerful. You know,
powerful enough to control the education in Rapid City.
In Rapid City, yes. Yeah. And they also, let me tell you some other examples. They, if you wanted a job at the Homestake Mining Company in the late 1920s, you had to have the approval of the local Klan, because it turned out the guy who was in charge of the employment office at the Homestake Mine was an active member of the Klan. And so if they didn't like you, you didn't get a job.
Mm. What other kind of artifacts have you found over the year, archives or artifacts?
A fellow by the name of Charles Rambo, Chuck Rambo, who lives in Sturgis, he also is an authority on the Klan in South Dakota, because his grandfather, Judge Catron, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, was a member in a similar situation. In his house after he died, they found a lot of Klan memorabilia, including, the regalia itself, all kinds of documents and membership certificates and so forth. So there is some of that material around. I think last I knew, he was displaying his at the Fort Meade Museum in Sturgis.
You mentioned in the first place, you know, the first family who found regalia just, you know, turned it in to the police. There's, what about, you know, what's your message for somebody who finds something like this in a loved one's belongings?
Well,
it's got to be quite a process.
Yes. Yeah, we have to save that. We have to save and preserve that. And it's not a pleasant part of our history. And that's not, I want to emphasize that I certainly don't approve of any of this. And as a historian, I find this a very distasteful subject. But it's part of what we were or who we were, and anything must be preserved, I feel, so that we can learn lessons from it.
Did you find any evidence of opposition in the state?
Oh, indeed so. And I want to emphasize that not everybody was pro-Klan. I think that at the highlight of the 1924 or 25, they had probably 5,000 members in South Dakota, and there were certainly groups. The American Legion in some cities were against the Klan and came out in full force. Governor McMaster said, "I'm going to watch these people carefully." He certainly did not approve of the KKK in South Dakota. He, as I said, they were monitored to some extent.
Did they conduct most of their activities in incognito? I mean, that might
well,
the image
no, no,
of
no,
you know
actually,
people with masks on goes
no,
through my head.
Well, Sioux Falls, of course, initially the mayor said, "You're not going to be able to wear a mask if you want to have a parade." No, they were very big on parades, and they had called them convocations or conventions, where thousands, in a couple of cases, came into South Dakota. Thousands of Klanners came in from, I can give you an example, Sturgis in 1924. They had several thousand Klansmen from four or five different states there. They had, again, parades and fireworks and speakers. And, no, they were very, very, very publicly in the picture, so to speak. They weren't hiding away behind in dark trees or anything.
Counter-protesters at those parades,
no.
Or how did the communities handle that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, in the extent that of the times, we never heard of any outward kind of protests against the Klan's arrival. I think people may have been disgusted. They certainly were disgusted later on when it was discovered that the national officials of the Klan were really, one of their big things is they were actually making money. They were making a lot of money from memberships in the KKK. Everybody split the pie for the annual membership fee. There was another fee to buy one of their costumes. The Imperial Palace, that's what they call the headquarters of the Klan in Atlanta, Georgia, was raking in about $2 million a month in the mid-20s. And this is $2 million of 1920 values. You know, it was extremely profitable. And then things started happening in the National Claverns, the Imperial Palace, the Grand Dragon of the Indiana Ku Klux Klan, which was really a regional Klan, was arrested for assault and rape of one of his young female employees. She died. A couple of other major officials were charged with murder. They had people who were embezzling funds from the Klan, and the IRS stepped in, and eventually the so-called Imperial Palace was shut down for non-payment of taxes, things like that. And that all got back to South Dakota, and people said, you know, this isn't about Americanism. This group is not about preserving our way of life. It's about less noble activities.
We've got about a minute left, Ken, and I'm just wondering what their relationship was with Native Americans then. If they were concerned about Native American Americanism, did that work?
Well, Native Americans were ignored pretty much by the Klan in South Dakota. They were living on the reservations, and they didn't consider them any kind of a threat.
Ken Stewart is Archives Research Administrator for the South Dakota State Historical Society. You can hear more about this topic 2 p.m. tomorrow at the Allen Chapel in Yankton. Ken Stewart, thank you so much. Fascinating stuff.
Thank you for having me this fine morning.